Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This week, it is the year ahead issue. The major trends, disruptions, breakthrough products, innovations, and movements to watch in the coming year. By the way, it's an opener, if you will, to this week's Bloomberg Live event happening in Davos, which is also occurring as the World Economic Forum hosts its annual meeting there.
And of course, we will have full coverage from Switzerland throughout the week on all of our Bloomberg platforms. We're not going there, right?
No. Okay. I just couldn't squeeze it in this year.
Okay. I'm just making sure. I haven't booked a flight yet, so I want to make sure. Ahead on this program, we're going to dive into Business Week's annual list of the 50 companies to watch over the next 12 months.
Always such a cool list. We're also going to break down a critical year for both the global travel and automobile industries as part of the magazine's look at the consumer. You know, me, you, Tim, everybody out there. We'll then examine Silicon Valley's changing business landscape when it comes to digital advertising and a long-held duopoly that is under a lot of pressure, more than ever, from tech rivals, both big and small.
That have become really valuable for advertisers. And not only are they valuable, but they're also accessible, not only to the big advertisers, but also to small businesses, which were kind of the bread and butter of the Meta and Alphabet's advertising business. So that first subset, I think, is the big one, these e-commerce retailers who are adding ads for businesses and really sniping some of that share, which started during COVID when everyone was online. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like they're really going to push forward in 2023.
Bless, we'll find out just how tough employers around the country are being on their workers when it comes to returning to the office. Look, we're here every day.
We certainly are.
Increasingly, we're starting to hear more and more companies are requiring their at least employees to come in 3 to 4 days a week.
Yeah, it's like, hey, team, remember us? Come on back in.
Such a difference than before the pandemic.
Yes.
And then later in the program, we're going to talk with the head of a cutting-edge aviation company that sees fully autonomous flight as the future.
How do you feel about that?
Not there yet.
Okay, me neither. All of that to come, we begin with Stephanie Flanders. She is Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor for Economics and Government. She's in from London this week at our global headquarters in New York and also found some time to pen the cover story in the Year Ahead issue. It's an essay breaking down why we can all expect the global economy of 2023 to be nothing short of a wild ride.
Well, let's talk about the year ahead because you write about these three pillars that kind of held together the global economy. Was helpful to have low rates, but it was also helpful to have a kind of a conflict-free world, you know, notwithstanding some minor conflicts here and there. And then also, of course, energy prices were kept low for quite a while. If we look back on 2022, those pillars all kind of crumbled.
Yes, and that's what I was thinking. So what's useful about doing this exercise for Business Week, and I have done it a few years now, is you sort of obviously, you're quite caught up in, especially these days, on exactly what's going to happen to the economy this year. And are we going to get our heads around inflation? Is the Fed going to stop tightening? But you also want to step back and think, okay, how has the world fundamentally changed? And I think this was one of those years where I thought, wow, we really have had these fundamental assumptions underpinning maybe 30, 40 years of global economic history, certainly my lifetime of thinking about economics and thinking about the world, all having kind of been kicked away over the last couple of years. It's not just cheap energy prices. It's not just cheap labor costs and transportation costs. And as you said, the sort of friction-free period for geopolitics, at least when it came to, you know, am I going to find it fairly easy to set up a complicated supply chain in Asia or China? And all of that has gone away. And then on top of all that, you know, you kind of every time any one of those pillars was sort of shaky, you always had the Fed put, right? You always had the Fed there, super easy money, kind of free money to make everything still, make the numbers still add up. And when you start looking ahead and thinking, okay, if those have gone in quite a lasting way, decoupling, whatever you want to call it, as well as potentially kind of higher interest rates sticking around for a while, you know, that could mean something quite fundamental, not just for economic growth, but also for global politics.
You know, we talk about pivots, and I do think about, Stephanie, is it just a case of a reset, certainly here in the United States, but elsewhere, this whole idea of cheap money, no more.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, as you know, I'm normally in London, and the sheer pace of change there has been extraordinary. I mean,
right. People,
you know, the difference between getting a mortgage in July and getting it in September, partly thanks to the sort of craziness we had in Parliament, but actually not just that, you had rates double or treble in many cases. People are going to be going up in the next few months, renegotiating their mortgages and going from a 1% rate to 6%.
Staring.
And they're going to fail their affordability tests. And, you know, so, yeah, we don't know how that's going to play out.
Well, how do you think about this? Like, this whole idea of the Fed still thinks they're going to get down to 2%, right, in terms of inflation. And that's their target. There are many people say, no way. Things have changed dramatically. How do you think about that globally? Like, has something, is it different this time around? Is there kind of a new rate because of some global macro forces that have changed forever?
Yeah, I think so. There's, as you know, a big debate about this.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of economists on both sides, as always, so we can keep up the debate.
Yeah.
But I think this year it's going to depend quite a lot on China. So you have the very rapid reopening actually may be unhelpful to the J-PALs of this world, because as you know, we could then see maybe an extra 1 percentage point, maybe an extra 2 percentage points on global inflation just because of faster China growth and higher energy prices from that. But looking further ahead, has there been a more fundamental shift between the relationship between unemployment and wages? You know, we've had all these years where you had super low unemployment, you know, very tight labor market, but wages didn't budge. Now, you know, the dam is kind of broken, and you have got these much bigger wage rises coming down the track in many countries. If they get locked in, then you're right. You know, we're in a different world.
You write at the end of the piece that the microeconomic trend for 2023 is going to be nearshoring. The idea of untangling some of these supply chains that companies have spent a generation building, as they've gotten concerned about, okay, maybe COVID zero in China or trade relationships with countries, including China. How do you think that's going to continue to play out? Because at the same time, it does seem like labor is so, you know, you don't want to unravel too much. And a company like Apple, for example, is so inextricably bound to a country like China.
Well, I actually think that's one of the fundamental tensions, and that's actually why I've set up a whole squad. Now I've got control of the economics and government here at Bloomberg. We've got a geoeconomic squad.
Yeah.
And precisely because the economics and the politics is really kind of coming into tension at the moment. I don't think any of these big companies want a niche nearshore particularly. It wouldn't be their first choice. It wouldn't be their choice to come out of China. And they're resisting that in many areas. But they're also looking at the writing on the wall, that as the geopolitical trends that we talked about from the last 30 years have gone into reverse. You know, the politicians, in a sense, are no longer on the side of closer and closer integration and globalization. So I think businesses, for the first time in a long time, have to reckon with, you know, if you like, the kind of the current of history running against them. You know, whereas previously, you know, in most places, people wanted to make things easier for global business. That's not the case now. You've got President Biden, you've got politicians all around the world actively making their lives harder.
It feels kind of glum in a lot of
sorry
ways.
About that.
No. You're not alone.
Like, even the good news in China is bad news.
Right, exactly. Like, and there was a lot of individuals say maybe it's not so great in the first half, better in the second half, but I think there's a lot of debate over that too. Could things actually come in better? Could the U.S. fare better too than the rest of the world or a lot of the world?
Yeah, and actually I even say that there. I think there's a scenario which says the U.S. dodges recession or has a very shallow recession. Even in the Eurozone, it's looking like, I don't think my optimism extends to the UK, alas, but in the Eurozone, it's looking like it's going to be a very shallow recession, and quite a lot of the countries may even dodge a formal recession. If we get to the end of the year and central banks have also kind of have basically got control of inflation and that we are within sight of 2%, then, as I say at the end of the piece, everything does become a bit easier. You know, we may still have these structural trends, these question marks, but it's on a slower burn, and you're not talking about these relationships just kind of going up in smoke.
Stephanie, does it feel, since you've said you've done this a couple of times for Business Week, kind of setting what the economic outlook is for the year, how does it feel different from last year? Do you remember, like, does it feel more certain or still uncertain but different debates?
I think the fundamental sort of narratives are actually clearer. And okay. Actually going back to that point of geoeconomics, I sort of feel like I know what the story is or what the different elements of the story are going forward. But of course, I never know what's going to happen. And that's what makes life so interesting.
Okay, 30 seconds just to end on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I think it's been almost a full year at the end of February. And, you know, 30 seconds again, Stephanie. I mean, how does this play out in Europe?
I would say one positive. I mean, of course, it's a massively negative event for the continent to have a war on its shores. But the way that Europe has hung together, not just the governments, but the people, I think is a source of inspiration and potential optimism. We'll see how whether they manage to carry that forward.
That was Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor for Economics and Government, Stephanie Flanders, on the cover story for the 2023 Year Ahead issue.
Coming up, from eBay to Porsche, the select group of global stocks to keep an eye on this year, for better or for worse.
The 50 is the real deal. And what basically the team of analysts at Bloomberg Intelligence does is take that 2,000 plus companies and push it through Excel sheets, and it spits out a couple dozen companies that we really want to kind of talk about. It's a great little mix of companies that we just think are going to have interesting years.
More from the Year Ahead issue. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
The latest issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, it is out now. It's online, on newsstands, of course, always on the Bloomberg terminal. It's the annual Year Ahead issue. Right now, though, we're going to talk about one of the favorite features of this issue, the 50 companies to watch.
The team at Bloomberg Intelligence tracks some 2,000 companies and sectors, ranging from communications and commodities to finance and food. BI has identified a select group of 50 that warrant a closer look this year based on a list of focus ideas, which combine contrarian views and upcoming catalysts for change.
You know, Tim, what our analysts do is they consider factors such as growth prospects, resilience in an inflationary environment, changes in the C-suite, and plans for new products and services. The team also weighs in on external conditions such as Russia's war in Ukraine, challenges in the tech supply chain, and the continuing effects of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Bloomberg Television and Radio Markets correspondent Kriti Gupta and I caught up with Business Week Solutions and Strategy senior editor Rebecca Penty, as well as the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber, to break down the list and also to better understand exactly how Bloomberg Intelligence narrows this field, Carol.
It's a feat what they do on any given day. And one of the things that we've long done with them is this project, which culminates, it's actually like months in the making and then culminates with the publication of the list. We've also gone on and done quarterly installments that we now do. So this is 50 companies to watch for the year, but you'll hear us come back and ahead of every quarter, we'll tell you companies to watch this quarter. But the 50 is the real deal. And what basically the team of analysts at Bloomberg Intelligence does is take that 2,000 plus companies and push it through Excel sheets, and it spits out just a couple dozen companies that we really want to kind of talk about. And we can't tell you these are buys and sells, that we're not going to do anything that foolish with that much conviction. But
we can look at hindsight as a measure of that.
Yeah,
list,
exactly.
Right?
That's what hindsight's for, right? We call this watch because some of them we expect will outperform and others might lag. And so it's a great little mix of companies that we just think are going to have interesting years. Rebecca was one of the Business Week editors who worked closely with BI to come up with that list and refine it and turn it into the magic that it is. Rebecca, I'm curious, what was the company that was the one that you liked the most on the list?
Well, I think Disney, and it was interesting. You know, BI has these focus ideas, and they, you know, basically they're high conviction ideas of companies where they think the market is not recognizing something about the company. And so either the market's undervaluing, overvaluing. And Disney was one of them that was really beat up during the pandemic and, you know, continues to be beat up once recession risks started looming because of all their theme parks. And the thing that was so interesting for me is that BI had this conviction that, you know, Disney is really poised for a rebound due to, you know, restructuring and accelerating the streaming strategy. And we'd already landed on Disney as a company, and then the announcement of Bob Iger's return as CEO. And so that just reinforced the view from BI that this is a company to watch. And I think, you know, the BI's view is that it could be a tale of two halves for Disney, where, you know, the second half is the stronger of the two.
Okay, well, if you're going to talk about Disney, we should talk about Netflix. And Netflix also on the list. Why did Netflix make it in that same conversation, since obviously it's been the dominant streaming video provider?
Yeah, that's true. And I think this is an interesting one where BI zeroing in on Netflix's ad-supported pricing tier. Now, for the longest time, it's been a company that's dependent on subscriptions, but not advertising. And so BI's view is that the market isn't fully recognizing the additional revenue and sales growth that could come from that advertising, which they see as supporting higher average revenue per user and offsetting cannibalization of subscription revenue from customers downgrading to cheaper plans.
Okay, so worth mentioning that two U.S. companies, perhaps you've heard of them, right?
I have heard of both of those.
What, the other thing I love about this project, though, Rebecca, is how global it is, right? So in addition to some marquee American names, tell us about ones that people outside of the U.S. might not even heard of.
Yeah, well, this one was an interesting one for me. I think, you know, we often hear about China being, you know, the world's manufacturing center, but we don't often know the names of the companies that make the stuff that we use. And one of the ones featured here is TSMC. It is the world's largest semiconductor foundry. And, you know, with the recession looming, with the economy taking a beating worldwide, chip making is slowing down. But Bloomberg Intelligence view is that TSMC is poised to better weather the cyclical market downturn than its peers because of its dominant industry position.
Yeah, it is a juggernaut, right?
Yeah. Joel, what about your favorite on this list?
Okay, well, I'll stick with tech. Okay. And I'm gonna say Sonos.
The little speaker company that could.
Yeah, it's truly, as we say in the blurb, it is a David versus Goliath moment. There's a patent case. It's been wrestling with Google for a really long time. As we write, BI is optimistic Sonos will succeed in the dispute, which goes to a jury trial in May. This has been a long time coming. This showdown has been, it's years in the making. Sonos has had its share of some challenges. If you're a Sonos user like I am, there's some software decisions that will make you pull your hair out.
Like that app needs a little bit of work.
Or which app? Because there's multiple apps, actually, in order to use different devices that don't talk to each other always. What, you know, is there more to talk about here? Yes, there is. But so I like the Sonos one. But, you know, that's another American company. We've done tech a little bit now. Rebecca, what's another international company that jumped out to you?
Okay, I'm just looking down the list.
I've got one, which was Porsche.
Okay, you've got one.
Let's
go ahead.
Let's talk about Porsche.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I thought, so this company went public this year, VW spin out, which is just also just an incredible IPO. But now they actually have to, like, you know, make some EVs. And autos, I think, are just a really interesting kind of year ahead story. We're seeing, obviously, the pressure on Tesla, and we're going to have more automakers sort of show up and attempt to hit velocity like Tesla's proven what a successful company can look like, and now they have to, like, wade through some challenges.
If I could just throw one quick one back in there.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about companies that are poised to do well on the EV theme. One of them that is maybe poised to fare worse off is Allison Transmission, another U.S. company. It's a truck transmission supplier. And what you may have heard about EVs is that, you know, it's not just regular cars, it's also trucks. So there's heightened competition in that truck space, which is going to be add some pressure to Allison Transmission.
That was Bloomberg Business Week Solutions and Strategy Senior Editor Rebecca Penty. And once again, the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber, Bloomberg TV and Radio's Kriti Gupta with us there as well.
And we should note that Rebecca mentioned Walt Disney at the top of our conversation. Now, you know, already this past week, we saw the company prepping for a challenge from activist investor Nelson Peltz and also naming Mark Parker as its new chairman.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, from the consumer-facing firms to Silicon Valley's elite, many iconic American companies are facing headwinds in the year ahead.
23 is going to be defined more about how consumers sort of, what's the new normal for consumers. In other words, lots of things changed. You obviously return to work, has been an issue, but also how people want to shop, how people want to consume, what people are willing to spend on, and the way the consumer behaves is a lot different than 2019. And so we want to capture that. And so we tried to sort of take a look at a number of areas.
This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Our coverage of the year ahead issue continues with a look at companies in the consumer space. The magazine taps into Starbucks' unhappy new year, the return of the jumbo jet, and the abrupt cratering of the used car market.
With a roundup, we turn to Bloomberg Businessweek Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis.
While the pandemic sort of defined last year, our sort of comeback from the pandemic, this year, 23 is going to be defined more about how consumers sort of, what's the new normal for consumers. In other words, lots of things changed. You obviously return to work, has been an issue, but also how people want to shop, how people want to consume, what people are willing to spend on, and the way the consumer behaves is a lot different than 2019. And so we want to capture that. And so we tried to sort of take a look at a number of areas. One I was obviously interested in was travel, because it's something I love, but it's also something that was really, really knocked during the pandemic. So I knew that was something we wanted to get into. And also, there were a lot of management shifts that happened over the pandemic period. And a lot of it was because of the way that consumers were changing what they wanted to do. A good example of that was Starbucks, simply because China was a big piece of its business. China was going to not behave this year the way it did before. And also, they were involved in a unionization drive that really picked up steam, over the course of the pandemic. So I knew I wanted that in there. So I went and sort of just tried to choose things that I thought, if I was a consumer, what would I care about now?
I love that you guys say, when it comes to Starbucks, could really use some caffeine this year.
Yes, indeed.
Well, they're getting it in the likes of bringing back Howard Schultz, so connected, obviously, with this company. It's like the old leaders are all coming back, Disney, Iger. But tell us, they've also got,
They've got a new CEO who's coming in who will work with Howard Schultz. We'll see how that works out. But
co-CEO thing always works.
Yeah. And he's coming. He was the former CEO of Reckitt. And the thing is that, he was very successful there. The problem is that it's a very different type of business. This is a true consumer business,
right,
that sells in, sort of sells food and drink in restaurants. Reckitt sells, condoms and other things, but it's
still sanitizing wipes
and
Lysol.
Consumer products, but they're not the same thing as selling at retail.
Yeah,
and so that's the real challenge. He's gonna have to learn that job at the same time that it has a big, big challenge in unionization of its stores, and also China, which is its second most important market, is still not back to normal. That's also supposedly the big growth market of Starbucks, and they hope that they're going to have 9,000 stores there something in a few years. That's going to be a real lift, given that China is still not fully back from the pandemic, and this guy has to figure out how to pull all this off at the same time that his predecessor, Howard Schultz, is still remaining on the board. And often founders, they tend to be sort of hands-on. And especially a founder like Schultz, who's already, had the CEO's job three times. He's already gotten rid of two people before.
That's a good point. Got to talk planes. Jumbo jets, important kind of, I feel like, to all the carriers.
And, But we previously thought they were no longer important.
That's right.
Kind of like the A380.
We said, oh my God, jumbo jets, they've got four engines. They, you know, they gobble up all this fuel. So therefore, we moved beyond that. And so we saw all these new, sort of what they call new generation planes, the 777X, the A350. I mean, planes and the Dreamliner, planes that were supposedly able to do with two engines everything that the old jumbos like the 747 and the double-decker A380 could do. And the problem is that we sort of retired a lot of those planes, and now demand has jumped back, and they say, like, oh my God, we need big planes, and we need big planes with big first classes.
All right, planes, skipping trains, automobiles. The used car market, man, that was on fire during the pandemic and right after, and now it feels like not so much.
Yeah, I mean, used cars were a real sort of boom time during the pandemic. What happened was that because the new car business was really constrained because of chips, because of shutdowns in auto plants in different parts of the world, prices went up on new cars because there was no supply. And what that meant was a lot of people couldn't afford new cars. And so they said, okay, I'll buy something on the used lot.
Right.
And that sent used car prices soaring. The problem for the used car business now is that in the last, 6 months, new cars have come back. Mm-hmm. You can get them on the lots again. You don't have these long waiting periods. And so the prices of used have dropped. And what that means is for people like CarMax and for Carvana, people whose business is heavily skewed toward that, they suddenly are have the demand, but also the values of the cars that they have in stock are dropping.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Businessweek Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis. Check out the new issue. There's also a story about Hollywood's comeback year.
Now to another area of the economy set for upheaval, the massive and increasingly crowded digital advertising market. Writing about a potential changing of the guard in the technology section is Bloomberg News tech reporter Alex Branca.
Once upon a time, there was a duopoly, and then some of the biggest competitors or rivals in the kingdom decided they liked what Alphabet and Meta had. So when you look out in 2023, in terms of the digital ad market, which, again, as a reminder, this is the money machine that basically funds the internet. Meta and Facebook and Instagram and Alphabet and its Google and YouTube have really owned this space, as you mentioned, for a long time. But this year, we have some folks pushing in with a lot of gusto, some rivals in competition that are huge. Names like Amazon and Walmart and Target. And I want to spend a moment on that group because this e-commerce set is probably one of the most threatening. They have started to roll out ads on the places where folks like you and I buy things. So right at that moment where we're making a decision, that have become really valuable for advertisers. And not only are they valuable, but they're also accessible, not only to the big advertisers, but also to small businesses, which were kind of the bread and butter of the Meta and Alphabet's advertising business. So that first subset, I think, is the big one, these e-commerce retailers who are adding ads for businesses and really sniping some of that share, which started during COVID when everyone was online. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like they're really going to push forward in 2023.
Well, all right. So, Alex, that's a big part of it, right? The competition for the digital ad market, that pie, right? There's more people going after that pie. That's one thing. But what about the impact still of that change by the Apple policy when it comes to privacy? Is that still, a bit of a sting for some of these big players?
Definitely a sting. So just to get everyone up to speed, Apple changed their policy, basically gave users the ability to opt out of what information is shared with advertisers. That made it much more difficult for folks like Meta and Alphabet to track the effectiveness of their ads and also to target people. And I mentioned those small businesses. A lot of those small businesses who built their businesses advertising on social media, they're the ones who took a really big hit here. So Apple kind of made that swipe, made it more difficult, made the ads less effective for Alphabet and Meta. And now, Bloomberg's reported that they're starting to add ad offerings of their own. So on the back of, this hangover from the changes Apple made, on the back of a really kind of choppy economic year where it seems like the digital ad market might not be growing forever, you then have all of these rivals pushing in to kind of take advantage of the stumble that Meta and Alphabet had in 2022.
What is the one company that could be the biggest competitor to Alphabet and Meta? I mean, I guess apart from TikTok.
I think that
Amazon is kind of this one that looms large, right? You mentioned Netflix, you mentioned some of the, the video streaming services. That's a smaller, kind of newer way of advertising that's starting to open up for small businesses. But the vast majority of folks who spend money to get their stuff seen by customers online are going to be small businesses. And Amazon's really done the most, and they have the biggest audience. That's really an attractive lure for businesses to advertise. That, you know, you're right there where somebody is making a purchasing decision and you're basically guaranteeing your stuff's going to get in front of the folks who are most likely to check out.
Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Brinka with us. Check out her full story. It's in the Year Ahead issue and the full interview on our Business Week podcast feed.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Up next, where the return to the office push stands entering the new year.
Castle Systems Chairman Mark Ein joins us. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
What will the year ahead mean for working from home, being in the office, and that hybrid work that we've been hearing about for so long? Hard to say, but one thing Tim and I can definitely say is that the New York City subway ridership recently hit a post-pandemic high of nearly 4 million. We're still a far cry from the more than 5.5 million riders who rode each day pre-pandemic. But Tim, the trend is definitely moving in the right direction, and that means more crowded trains. We're seeing that firsthand.
Yeah, I am standing room only a lot of the trains to and from the office. So are people actually going back to the office? And what does 2023 have in store? Mark Ein is chairman of Castle Systems. His company provides security services for offices here in the U.S. Think of swiping your badge when you go into the office. Mark joined us with some insight and, of course, some data.
So look, I think we do have to keep this in perspective. From the beginning of 22 to the end of 22, the average utilization of office space nearly doubled. We started the year in the mid-20s and we ended the year near 50% on a national average. So while sometimes it feels like it's not fully back to normal, it was a huge increase last year, and there was a meaningful increase after Labor Day. And so that's what the data shows. We also have noticed over the last several years since the pandemic started that employers generally use big calendar events to put stakes in the ground and ask people to come back. And consistently, the two biggest have been Labor Day and New Year's. And we know from talking to our clients and users of office space that use Castle, that a bunch of the companies that have had policies wanting people to come back, if not all the time, at least some of the time, are starting to enforce them more strongly. And many of them use the beginning of the year after New Year's as a stake in the ground. And so we did see a meaningful increase last year, and we think that you're going to continue to see a meaningful increase as we start 2023.
I'm looking at the Castle Back to Work Barometer Average available on the Bloomberg Terminal. Just type in KSL BWA1. And I got to tell you, it is looking like it is a far cry from where we were right before the pandemic hit. If we look at it on the level of 100 back in March of 2020, we're right now, the highest we've been is what, close to 50 at one point, Mark. So do you think we get back to pre-pandemic levels?
I don't think we get back to 100% if 100% is the pre-pandemic baseline. I think you need to go one step deeper and to continue sort of where I'd left off. What you do notice, though, when you look at days of the week, is that on certain days of the week, namely Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, the occupancy is meaningfully higher and it's meaningfully lower on particularly Fridays and Mondays. And so when you go a level deeper, what you see is that, well, what you just quoted were the averages across the week, but on a national average on Friday, it's 33%, whereas on a national average on, I think it's Tuesday or Wednesday, it's roughly the same, is 55%. But some markets like in Texas, those numbers are now in the 60s and 70s on the high days. So what's clear is that people are using office space differently. It's less consistent across a week. The spread in the low day to the high day on a national average went from 9% at the beginning of 22 to now 22% at the end of 2022. And so I think you have to look at it in that lens, that I think what you're going to see is on the peak days, you're going to continue to see an increase. The Fridays and Mondays are probably going to lag, and that's going to keep the weekly average down pretty meaningfully.
That was Mark Ein. He is the chairman of Castle Systems. That wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to expectations for global climate change in the year ahead and beyond, and how markets may be filling a void that governments won't.
Plus, new advances in aviation are on the horizon. We'll talk to the head of a company that's using artificial intelligence to fly planes, dun-dun-dun, autonomously.
What that enables is that Jetson's future, in a far distant future where aircraft are flown completely without human air crew aboard, but baby steps to be able to really get there.
Are you ready?
Nope.
I don't know. There's still a pilot in there. At least for now.
Yeah, but does it mean it eventually goes away?
I don't know. All right. Yeah, well, maybe not in our lifetime.
TBD.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a look into the future of aviation. We'll do that with the CEO of Merlin Labs. It's a company intent on propelling the nascent business of fully autonomous flight.
So for our operators, being able to go introduce an AI pilot to be able to go augment human crews is just like really fundamental to them being able to go keep up with the demand for the air network. So it's been really exciting. It's the inevitable future of aviation, and we're delivering on that inevitable future of aviation in a really pragmatic crawl, walk, fly approach.
Plus, we dive into the pursuits section of the magazine for a look at some of the cultural touchstones to have on your radar right now, from arts and entertainment to why Formula One wants to put women in the cockpit for the first time in nearly 50 years. We're going to break it all down for you.
Look forward to that. First up this hour, the year ahead issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine includes a section devoted to the green economy and alternative energy space. Certainly timely considering the extreme weather that we've seen in California throughout the past week or so. And really, as the world noted, that the last 8 years were the hottest on record. For gut check on the global climate, we caught up with the editor of the Bloomberg Sustainability team, Eric Roston.
The sad fact, I guess, or maybe there's some something we can take from this, is that the annual temperature record has become quite predictable. As you said, the last 8 years are the hottest on record, dating back to the middle of the 19th century. It's 9 years in according to NASA. And what's interesting is the predictability of global warming, the reliability, for what it's worth, of the extra heat that the Earth is taking on. It's counterintuitive, but the annual temperature record actually says something else other than the globe is warming. Because, like, obviously the globe is warming. Every decade has been warmer than the last since the 1960s. But back-to-back temperature years really give you more information about weather variability, about whether there was an El Nino or a hot period in the Pacific, or a cool La Nina. Last year there was a La Nina, so it was not a record year. It was only, in quotation marks, the fifth hottest year.
Well, that variability is really what I want to talk about, and the idea of linking that kind of large-scale stuff to the extreme storms that we're starting to see. I mean, Carol, I don't know about you, but it's like every few weeks there's some, you know, once in a lifetime storm,
right,
once in a generation snow that disrupts air travel over the holidays. And then a few weeks later, there's a once in a century storm in California that leads to, what, 17 deaths. I don't know, Eric. I mean, it doesn't seem like once in a lifetime or once in a generation to me anymore.
That's exactly right. And I think the last 5 to 10 years have been continuing education in what climate change really means. And one thing you hear and will continue to hear, particularly in the summer, is that every hottest summer you've ever experienced is the coolest summer of the rest of our lives.
It's crazy. I was thinking about that. I was trying to tell my daughter, she's 19, and I said, you know, growing up, we had about a week in the summer. I grew up just outside New York City, a week where my parents are like, all right, let's put the air conditioning on. We literally go from like winter to air conditioning, and it's on all season.
Well, and I've talked about this before. My brother lives in Seattle. He's lived there for years. He just installed air conditioning there these houses were never built with air conditioning in mind because you didn't need it until now.
London, right?
Well, that's an extremely interesting anecdotal example of something we have seen. Last year, the Pacific Northwest saw one of the most insane heat waves that has ever been recorded. And air conditioning, as much as we're used to it in temperate regions, is a critical life-saving tool that we're going to rely on increasingly as the temperature gets higher.
Is our infrastructure... Let's go through. This is a
no.
really interesting story.
No.
You say, we know 2022 was hot. Here are five climate change unknowns. And one is, you ask the question, how resilient are societies? Is our infrastructure ready to deal with climate change? And
sorry, I gave it away.
No. No, no, and no.
If I can quote Tim when he said no. I spoke the other day with a well-known climate scientist named Andrew Dessler, who's at Texas A&M. And I said, I asked him to just be glib, you know, it's like the temperature record, we know what it's going to be, but like, what else should we be thinking about if we know that we can predict this? And that's what, and he gave me five things. And one of them, he talked about the lack of resilience and about how small departures from the temperatures that we're used to are starting to wreak havoc. And, you know, all of our infrastructure was built for the narrow band of weather that we got used to over the last century. Mm-hmm. Texas temperatures, you know, temperatures dropped like 10 degrees or so Fahrenheit below, you know, what they're occasionally used to in Texas. It caused $195 billion in damage and killed almost 250 people.
It's incredible. I mean, it's awful. And it doesn't just happen in the summer. It happens in the winter as well. We saw this play out
right.
just a couple of weeks ago when so many people were concerned and even indeed lost power in, again, a once-in-a-generation storm. Is there political will, given that these are such huge projects that need to be undertaken in order to fix grids, whether it's Texas, whether it's the Northeast? Because it's happening so much, is there the political will to actually get these projects done?
If I can go back to your famous quotation,
I think it's
almost like tautological. Like if there were political will, we would be seeing improvements. We've never seen a policy put in place at the scale that has long been recommended by scientists and other observers, by business, by investors. You know, the good thing is, like the miraculous thing, is that we haven't needed it in a lot of ways. You know, like between solar and wind and electric cars and batteries, the rate of invention and technological penetration and change is so much faster than anybody ever would have dreamed 10 years ago, it's really encouraging.
Because we have to?
Because
the government's saying you got to, or what?
We definitely, it's not coming from the government. Like all of the solar, all of the wind, all the car stuff, like very little of it, at least in the United States, happened because Washington wanted it to happen. Washington, if anything else, has been, a drag in some specific instances. But the fact is that the market works and the market wants this to happen. And so it's happening.
I do think about, is it too late? Like, I think about the melting ice sheets and stuff. Like, there's some things, I don't know, Eric, with the folks that you talk to, the people who really get this and your team who really get this, is there no way to go back?
There is. One of the most emboldening scientific discoveries of the last several years was really came to prominence in 2021 in a big UN climate report. And they really, for the first time, said with great confidence that if pollution stops, warming will stop shortly thereafter. For many years, it was confusing. They didn't know. They thought maybe there was more warming built in the pipeline. So that even if emissions ended tomorrow, you know, it would still warm for some time. Like it's a big help. You know,
like I think about during the pandemic, like Tim and I were talking about it earlier, like all of a sudden the blue skies were coming back and animals were coming out. It was really like very telling.
Yeah.
Right?
Another story that I think is very powerful and is probably not seen by as many people as it should is is the ozone hole, which was the environmental plague of the 1980s, is getting better. You know, it's healing and it's going to continue to heal. And that's great. But the powerful message there is that that was done by policy. You know, that was done in 1987 by countries getting together, recognizing the problem and finding industrial alternatives to the chemicals that were causing it. So, you know, while climate change is bad and while, you know, people unfortunately are harmed and die every year because of climate events. But like the ozone story is just a very powerful lesson in the fact that we can pass policies that fix these problems. Back to your question, is all it takes is political will. You know, and even that on the margins is changing.
That was Eric Rostin. He's the editor of the Bloomberg Sustainability Team. And be sure to read more on the green economy and energy in the Year Ahead issue. It includes stories about the carbon capture gold rush and why 2023 will be the year your home turns into a power plant. It's out on newsstands, online, and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course, always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. While we're on the topic of innovation in the energy and green space, up next, we'll talk to the head of a company using AI, artificial intelligence, to help bring autonomous aircraft into the mainstream.
Elevators without human operators were really scary at one point, and then the technology matured to the point where we were able to go deliver that safely. Trains without human operators were really, really scary. And then the technology got to the point that we were able to go do it. So we believe in Merlin and the crawl, walk, fly approach to be able to go get there, to be able to go do it safely, and to build that public regulatory and operator trust in the system.
Merlin Labs CEO Matt George stops by. That's on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, for any members of our audience who may not be aware, my co-host Tim Stenovec is a bit of a plane fan. Is that a safe way of describing it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what does that mean?
I just like watching planes take off and land and like going to aviation museums. Do you go to normal stuff.
Do you go to airports and just hang out?
I have in the past.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, my wife for my birthday one year got, like, we went to the TWA hotel and got like a room that overlooked the runway. It's pretty cool.
Oh my God, that is so sweet. All right, we know you like planes. Well, earlier in the broadcast, we talked about the commercial aviation business and what we can expect from that industry in the year ahead. In this next segment, we're going to look at a different corner of the business that's attracting attention from the likes of the U.S. military, autonomous aircraft. And we're not talking about drones. These are full-size planes. For more, here's Tim and Bloomberg TV and radio markets correspondent Kriti Gupta.
I don't know about you, Kriti, but when I get on an airplane, I always look to the left and I like to see a couple of pilots in the cockpit getting ready to fly that plane to wherever I'm going. Here's the thing. Those days might be coming to an end where we have actual human pilots in the plane with us. Is it going to happen during our lifetimes? Merlin Labs is an aviation technology company that's working on AI technology to allow planes to fly fully autonomously. They've got the tech already. They use them in King Airs right now. The company over the summer raised more than $100 million to bring their total funding to about $130 million. Matt George joins us now. He's the CEO of Merlin Labs. Everyone knows I love talking planes, so this one I've been pretty excited about. So are we going to be taking passenger flights without human pilots in the plane with us anytime soon?
Yeah, I want to pour some cold water on that.
Okay.
The pathway for autonomy is really adjunctive to pilots. So a lot of the stuff that we're working on at Merlin is truly how to be able to go create an AI pilot. But unlike some others in the space, we fundamentally don't believe that you can put that pilot alone in the cockpit, at least at first.
Alone in the cockpit, meaning the co-pilot will still need to be there? Or meaning that you could fly with just one pilot?
Yeah. So we are working a lot with our operators. We made a big announcement in the United States Air Force about being able to go pair the Merlin pilot, which is what we're developing, with a human pilot to enable safe aircraft operation. So just like any student pilot, there's a really, really, really long period where that pilot has to be supervised and trained by a human. And it's the same with any AI system. And once again, we're starting out first with some of our partners in the Defense Department, specifically working on some cargo and mobility applications, and then also working in the civilian realm on cargo. So the end state of Merlin is being an adjunctive pilot on large passenger aircraft. But then also what that enables is that Jetson's future in a far distant future where aircraft are flown completely without human air crew aboard. But baby steps to be able to go get there.
Far distant. How many years is that?
Oh, I, if I had a crystal ball, I would be in a very, very, very different business. But we will be performing our first commercial flights, certified commercial flights, in the next about 2 years, okay, with the Merlin pilot in charge, but still with a you know, human crew member sitting next to the Merlin pilot.
Well, as incredible as that all sounds, it also sounds a little terrifying, I'm not going to lie. Talk to us a little bit about the pushback that you're getting here.
Yeah, so anything in aviation has to be done super safely, right? Like there's a reason that flying is actually one of the safest activities you can do, much more so than driving. And that reaction is like really real. So that's why we believe that the autonomous system has to be paired with a human pilot, and not just sort of putting anybody alone, you know, sort of in an aircraft that's totally uncrewed. But once again, right, elevators without human operators were really scary at one point. And then the technology matured to the point where we were able to go deliver that safely. Trains without human operators were really, really scary. And then the technology got to the point that we were able to go do it. So we believe in Merlin and the crawl, walk, fly approach to be able to go get there, to be able to go do it safely, and to build that public regulatory and operator trust in the system. But once again, it's not going to be overnight where the aircraft are flying without anybody aboard. There's a long period where a computer and trained human pilot are teaming up together to provide a really safe experience, first for boxes and cargo, and then eventually for people.
So I don't, you know, we've been covering this for a couple of years, but the pilot shortage that's played out here in the U.S. since COVID is really creating some difficult situations for many operators. What are you hearing from commercial aviation firms, airlines, about their desire for this type of technology? Because not only would it save them a ton of money, but it would alleviate a lot of headaches, too.
Yeah, so the internet provides ubiquitous digital connectivity for the world, and then the air network provides ubiquitous physical connectivity. So as people buy more and more things online, I don't think there's anybody who realistically believes in a world where folks are going to start buying stuff less online. So as people buy stuff more online, the demand on the air cargo network is shot through the roof. So for our operators, being able to go introduce an AI pilot to be able to go augment human crews is just like really fundamental to them being able to go keep up with the demand for the air network. So it's been really exciting. It's the inevitable future of aviation, and we're delivering on that inevitable future of aviation in a really pragmatic crawl, walk, fly approach.
Well, talk to us a little bit about the business itself, because I'm reading a little bit about your company here. Founded in 2018, you're headquartered in Boston. You've got offices around the country. You look like you also have offices in New Zealand.
Yeah. We have an incredible team in New Zealand. We partnered with the government of New Zealand to be able to go certify the first version of the Merlin pilot, and that's a joint certification program between the New Zealand Civil Aviation Authority and the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. New Zealand has built an incredible reputation as being a nimble, agile regulator that's able to go try new things and do that in a really safe and reliable way. So we are standing up the world's first fully autonomous, still with a safety pilot, but fully autonomous takeoff to touchdown air cargo network on the North Island of New Zealand, based in Kerikeri in the Bay of Islands in New Zealand. And New Zealand really is you know, going to be one of the first places in the world where a lot of the autonomy takes place first, gets tested, and then exported into the rest of the world. And we're super proud of our partnership between the U.S. and New Zealand and being a really critical link between those two countries.
Yeah, it looks like even in New Zealand right now, just to speak to that reputation that it's built, you can get drone delivery of certain products through Wing, food, coffee, hardware, pet supplies, and more. So not surprised to see that you have a presence in an environment that has a regulatory environment such as that. So Matt, before we let you go, talk to us a little bit about this partnership that you have with the U.S. Air Force, the Super Hercules transport aircraft. So what can you do in the U.S. Air Force do now to the Super Hercules that you weren't able to do a couple of years ago?
Yeah, we're really excited about our partnership with the United States Air Force, who clearly has been trying to bring autonomy out into operational service for a really long time. And the challenge always is the problem and the question that you alluded to at sort of the start of our chat. How do you get from where we are today to fully uncrewed operations?
Yeah.
The Air Force has partnered with us to be able to go do sort of that two crew, an augmented service.
That was Matt George. He's the CEO of Merlin Labs. He spoke with Akriti Gupta and me on Monday.
So after speaking with him, were you even more comfortable about getting into something that didn't have a maybe person?
Well, we're years away from... it's being fully autonomous.
Do you think it's really years?
It's more assistance right now. Okay. Yeah, I do think it's more years. I mean, it's such a highly regulated environment, and I think passengers would say no way.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're working with the military right now on those transport planes.
I think it's really interesting. All right, still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, the year ahead in luxury and culture with our intrepid colleagues from Bloomberg Pursuits, including a look at how the City of Light is reclaiming its place at the top of the European art scene.
When it comes to commerce in the top of the art market, other cities, particularly London and New York, have really been at the top for a long time because they have big fairs and they have really the presences of the world's major galleries. But Paris in the last few years, especially with this last year with a major art fair, has kind of been coming back as a place where people go to buy and trade art.
It's just another reason to head to Paris, as if you needed another one.
Exactly.
This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, as you know, the year ahead issue, it is out, and it wouldn't be complete without a peek into what 2023 may hold when it comes to our worlds of luxury and culture. Have no fear, the Bloomberg Pursuits team is here.
Joining us now, we've got Pursuits editor Chris Rouser, along with Bloomberg Pursuits arts columnist James Tarmey. James has got the lead story in this week's Pursuits section about how the Paris art scene has come roaring back to life. Chris, first up, okay, so I got to be honest about this. Maybe it's because I don't know about art and culture, but I didn't realize that Paris...
I believe it's culture.
Culture. I didn't realize that Paris wasn't kind of at the top when it came to the art scene. I mean, where did I go wrong?
If you are like an attendee of museums, certainly Paris is one of the greatest cities in the world.
Yeah. Have you heard of the Mona Lisa?
Not going anywhere.
Okay.
But when it comes to commerce in the top of the art market, other cities, particularly London and New York, have really been at the top for a long time because they have big fairs and they have really the presences of the world's major galleries. But Paris in the last few years, especially with this last year with a major art fair, has kind of been coming back as a place where people go to buy and trade art. And so we had James told me this. And
so you didn't. Okay, that makes me feel better, Chris, that you're the editor and you didn't know this.
You're like, really? Come on.
That's always a good sign for a story, though.
James, come on in on. Tell us about the pitch and then actually, you know, more of what's going on there in Paris.
I have to say that I was kind of shocked when I went maybe right after COVID and the transformation had been kind of complete. It had been in the works for years. As I say in my piece, it's not just one thing, but if you were to trace it back, you can see this huge infusion of capital from the city's luxury barons, François Pinault, Bernard Arnault, then the Cartier Foundation, then the family behind Galeries Lafayette, the department store. All of these people had been pouring money, not just into the art world, but specifically contemporary art. And that sort of fed this ecosystem of not only art galleries, but also art fairs, also contemporary art exhibitions, and then also artists themselves.
Well, does it always take a benefactor, such as a Bernard Arnault, to kick something off like this? Or does it turn into sort of a sustaining cycle?
Well, it's funny because, you know, contemporary art follows the money. With art that's being made, you need someone to pay for it. And if you don't have anyone to pay for it, you're not going to really find out about it very often. A lot of these really, really rich people are funding these private museums, which buy from galleries, which buy from artist studios, and which have cutting-edge exhibitions, which, of course, then feeds more galleries and feeds more artists coming to the city. And, you know, the curators who are involved in these private museums are very involved in fostering the art scene. So does it take one person? No. But does it take rich people? Absolutely. And you can actually look at Berlin, which for a very long time was this place that everyone was so excited about, to actually see what happens when there aren't a lot of rich people. Eventually, artists migrated elsewhere because they just weren't getting enough traction from the people who mattered. Paris has a lot of people who matter.
The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting is, yeah, it's a lot of wealthy folks coming in and private money, if you will. But the government, right, Chris, in France is also super supportive, not only in its actions, but also in financial support.
Yeah, so France is very generous with its arts funding, more than a lot of other European countries. Last year, it spent more than 4 billion euros on it. In Germany, as to what James was just saying, spent about 2.3 billion euros. So it's, you know, this is a lot of money that's available in a lot of different ways for artists and enjoyers of art to take advantage of.
Okay, Chris Rouser, so let's say you want to take a little trip to Paris, but maybe you want that little trip to be an extended stay.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Why not? Why not?
Go to one of those great boutique hotels.
Increasingly now,
sorry,
these boutique hotels, or at least big companies, I should say, are betting on extended stay businesses. And it's in the new issue of Bloomberg Pursuits in Bloomberg Business Week. So take us into why the big hotels are kind of getting in on this. I mean, does it have anything to do with Airbnb?
Yeah, it does. It has it to do with a lot of things. So a lot of really big hotel companies are getting into a space that we used to probably think of as maybe a little bit sad. So an extended stay hotel, you might think of it as like a sort of a grab, like a place where a traveling salesman would stay in a strip mall somewhere, and it's a very cookie cutter beige room, probably smells like cigarettes. And or maybe it's a thing where like
Chris Rouser's like opinions are his own. No, sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
Or maybe there's like a duchess who like moved to New York and she's staying at the Waldorf and she's living there for a long time.
That sounds less sad.
Yeah. So it's, you know,
yeah, it's a different kind of sad.
Big companies like Hyatt and Marriott are getting into the middle range of extended stay hotels, which are, you know, more luxurious, more comfortable, maybe even more comfortable than your home. And feeling very homey because they know that people can work from anywhere these days. And the idea of living in another city at a sort of a reasonable rate, but with the comforts and conveniences of a hotel is a big business. And of course, even before the pandemic started that trend, we saw Airbnb really take over the world and turn, open up a lot of avenues for staying for a while with the conveniences of home, but far from home.
Now, I know, James, when you went over to Paris to do your story, it was all work and no play.
Of course. That's how James rolls.
Totally.
But Chris, this is a big deal. We're like, people want to combine, yep, we're going to do some work, but we're also going to have some play.
Yeah. I mean, leisure is probably one of the most painful words that we've come across recently. Portmanteaus, as far as they go.
Agreed.
But it's really true. And, you know, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these, and we're seeing them everywhere from Tokyo to Bangkok to Atlanta, Georgia. Oh. And the idea is kind of like they're built around communities, a lot of these new places. So, you know, there's communal spaces. There's a coffee shop that turns into a bar at night. Maybe you walk up a staircase to your room instead of an elevator, which makes you feel a little bit more like you're at home and in a connected space. And in a lot of cases, these are being built attached to stadiums or concert halls or malls or even airports, so that there's like an additional lifestyle aspect or community or travel aspect sort of built right into where you're going to be.
Right. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, maybe you're going to experience something. Like maybe you want to go see an F1 race. How do you like this for a segue?
That's a good segue.
Can we get to another story in the section? F1, women in the cockpit for the first time in about 50 years. What's going on, Chris?
So, you know, as Americans, we have really caught on to F1 pretty recently. And, you know, part of it has to do with that Netflix show, which everybody really loved, Drive to Survive. And it really made the characters of F1, the drivers, into these people that we sort of fell in love with a little bit. And if you watch the show, you'll notice that they're all men. And it's not that there are no women drivers out there. It's just that there's not been really a funnel for women drivers in the various competitions that feed into Formula One. There's not really been a funnel for them explicitly to try to get into Formula One. And it's certainly not that Formula One only has men's racers. There have been female racers, but the last one was in 1976. And Hannah Elliott writes this story. I mean, she's the perfect person to write this story because she has a great perspective on the auto industry from the perspective of one of the few women columnists. And this woman, Lella Lombardi, who raced in 1976, was a former delivery van driver for her family's butcher shop in Italy.
It's amazing.
And when a journalist asked her how it felt to drive such big cars, she said, "I don't have to carry it. I just have to drive it."
Exactly.
So hey, you ask a dumb question, you get a good answer, okay?
You feel like there was like, "Hey, little lady, how did you do this?" Like, that's what's going on. A great section. Looking forward to the new year and all of the coverage you guys are going to be doing from the Pursuits team. So you guys, thank you so much.
Big thank you to Bloomberg Business Week arts columnist James Tarmey and Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, a new book explains how to win the fight against perpetual distraction in our increasingly digital world.
What was that? What'd you say? I was doing something else.
Not funny.
Okay. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
So how many times do you sit down to do something only to be distracted by the ping of your phone? So you pick it up, you look at the text, and the next thing you know, you're on Instagram watching videos of airplanes, Tim, taking off and landing.
Yeah,
and
then, I wrote that.
40 minutes has passed, and you never got to that thing that you sat down to do. How often does that happen?
Like every day.
It is crazy. Like, I feel like I'm working on something and then like something comes at me, an email, and I'm off. And then I start Googling and I'm down a rabbit hole and I'm like, what was my initial task?
Yeah. My question is there any hope, right?
There has to be.
Well, it sounds like I know a little thing or two about this. Mm-hmm. It's because it's the kind of, you know, what happens in our lives right now. Getting that focus back is the subject of a new book. It's called Attention Span by Dr. Gloria Mark. She's Chancellor's Professor of Informatics at the University of California, Irvine. And we asked whether our various digital stimuli are affecting our brains.
There's some research that suggests that there could be some changes to our brain. What I can say is that there are changes to our behavior, to our attention behaviors. And that's something that we can, you know, empirically measure and show. We also show that there's a relationship between this fast attention shifting and an increase in stress.
How about behavior change? Because I want to know how I can, and I notice this, sometimes I'll delete Twitter from my phone because I know I'm spending too much time on it. Even though the app is no longer on my phone sometimes, I'll still open up my phone instinctively when I'm like on an escalator, in an elevator or something, and then try to find Twitter, even though I know it's not there. It's like a reflex for me.
Or sickness.
No, please help me, doctor.
Yeah, it's a muscle memory. I mean, you know, when you do something for a long time, it becomes a habit. You know, and I want to emphasize that we tend to blame notifications for, you know, this is the reason why we're distracted. But it's just as likely for people to interrupt themselves. So about half the time, we are our worst interrupters. You know, so it's not, we can't just blame it on things that are external to us.
Remember when multitasking, Dr. Mark, was considered a good thing?
But, you know, the research shows that it's not. There's actually research that's been going on for decades that shows that when people switch their attention to different tasks, we know that blood pressure goes up. There are physiological markers that indicate stress that show this goes up as well. We know my own research looking at people in the wild where they wore heart rate monitors, we find that stress goes up when people are switching their attention. And people report subjectively that their stress is higher. So all these measures are consistent.
So how do we find focus and fight distraction, which is the subtitle of your book?
We need to do work on different levels. There are individual solutions. There are also collective solutions that could be done at an organizational level or even societal level. At an individual level, I think that we can draw on the work of Albert Bandura. He's a very famous social psychologist who had a lot of success in getting people to improve their self-efficacy. They could change, they could stop smoking, stop substance abuse. And I think there are certain principles that could be applied to help us, you know, control our attention better. For example, we have so many automatic actions. We grab our phones, we check email, we check social media. These are done automatically.
Dr. Gloria Mark is the Chancellor's Professor of Informatics at the University of California, Irvine. Her new book is out now. It's called Attention Span.
I'm just going to start putting my headphones on more.
What?
Did you say something?
Yeah, I don't know what you're
talking
about.
Funny. All right, that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune in to Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And you can also see us on Bloomberg Quick Take. We're available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Stay safe. This is Bloomberg.